You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These, where we talk about the differences between us without letting them divide us. And sometimes we talk about reconciliation. Now, humans are not built to recant or regret or have revelations. They are built to make and sustain beliefs, even in the face of overwhelming evidence that they're wrong. This is what makes Amber Scora's story of leaving her faith all the more fascinating. She was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, a Christian sect that descended from the Millerites, a doomsday cult in the mid-1800s, whose followers never stopped believing that the end would come, even as the predicted date came and went and came and went and came and went. The Millerites' experience is the basis for a specific theory in social psychology laid out in a book called When Prophecy Fails. And that's the idea that those who hold extreme beliefs, if presented with contrary evidence, will actually become more devout and more assertive in their proselytizing and develop new interpretations of their scripture as a way of dissolving the disappointment and tension that come with having to face reality. You may have some notion about how this theory is relevant beyond Amber's personal and statistically atypical story. Amber Scora is a writer living in Brooklyn, New York. Her articles have been published in the New York Times, The Believer, and USA Today. Prior to coming to New York, Scora lived in Shanghai, where she was the creator and host of the podcast Dear Amber, The Insider's Guide to Everything China. She is here to talk about her first book, Leaving the Witness, Exiting a Religion and Finding a Life. So, Amber, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to talk about your book. Do you want to just give us like a back cover, you know, synopsis really quick before we get deeper?
Yeah, I was a third generation Jehovah's Witness, and I was so devout, believed it so fully that I learned Mandarin and moved to China to preach.
That is intense. That's a lot.
I really believed it. Yeah. And when I was in China, because the work was done underground, because it was illegal, it was done underground, I had some space from the community that I had at home for the first time. And having that distance, a little bit of mental space as well as physical space, basically started to turn my world upside down slowly. Also being in a new culture and language caused me to see my religion with different eyes. And I started to see some cracks in my faith. And not only cracks, just some things that seemed like they didn't add up, but some things that started to bother me. And ultimately, I left the religion because this is not a religion where you can do it halfway. And for that, I was shunned by my family and all of my friends and basically had to start my life over again already in my 30s.
I love that couple paragraphs still isn't enough to cover everything in the book.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much more in it. But obviously, we want to get into the nitty-gritty of your journey. And I understand you have an excerpt to kind of place us at a point in it.
Yeah. This excerpt, I'm already in Shanghai at this point, and I've been there a while as a Jehovah's Witness. I've already learned how we do our work secretly, and I've started to cultivate friendships with people in order to convert them into Bible studies when I knew that the people were safe, as in they wouldn't turn us into the authorities or anything. So by this point in the book, I have a couple Bible students and I meet them sort of in clandestine locations and study the Bible with them and have discussions about basically trying to teach them what I believe to be the truth. In particular, there's one Bible student who became a very close friend. Her name was Jean. And at this point in the book, we've been studying for a little while and our friendship is deepening. Jean and I began to spend as much time talking about other things as we did about the Bible. We both enjoyed our study, but also looked forward to the moment the chapter was finished and our books were put discreetly back into our bags and our other conversations could begin. What had started with Jean had also begun to wedge itself in my other Bible studies. When I gave them their copies of our publications and a Bible, the covers carefully wrapped so as not to alert any around us as to their content, I had felt as though I was a bestower of truth, a giver of happiness, and the peace of mind that I had myself. I was convinced I could save these people here in a noisy corner of a McDonald's or on the bench of a shopping mall. But as my Chinese improved, I began to notice that the people I studied with were reacting in ways I hadn't picked up on before I understood the culture and language to the degree I did now. Occasionally, I would feel a flush of embarrassment as I sensed a shift in tone as the student across the table read through a paragraph in the book. This is from the book. As soon as Jesus became king, he threw Satan and his wicked angels out of heaven and down to the locality of the earth. That is why things have become so bad here on earth since 1914. 1914? The date seemed to get larger and weirder the longer we stared at it on the page. This date had been a given in my life, and its significance as the beginning of the end times was beyond question for me. In fact, there was a whole chain of scriptures I had written down from one of our publications that I could use to prove its truth. But as we read through the paragraphs and talked about the pictures in the book, it occurred to me that some of this seemed to my students quaint, or silly even. A look or a pause would reveal to me that some of the things I had taken as lifelong truths, things that I had built my life around, seemed just crazy to them. At times, I would cringe inside when I noticed that what I said could have been insulting, perhaps even arrogant. The things I taught as universal truths completely disregarded the lived experience of much of the world's population. Creation, one God, everlasting life, stay away from worldly family members, marry in the Lord. There was no one in the Lord to marry here. Don't care about money, don't get an education. They would sometimes laugh a little, especially at this last idea. As I read to them from the Bible, I myself began to wonder about what was going on in the world outside of the Middle East in the same era, counting back in the timeline of Chinese history to figure out what was happening in Asia when Jesus was flinging Satan out of heaven or curing the sick. Still, I taught them that this religion I told them about was the chosen one, better than all the others, the so-called Christian religions, Buddhism, Islam, Taoism, Mormonism, all of them. I did so without question as to the veracity of my conviction. But what I did wonder about was why my conviction in my rightness was any less valid than that of any other true believer. Why had God made it such that some people, like me, grew up in a society that revolved around Christianity, and others in one that revolved around entirely different yet equally moral systems of belief? And why was the price for that everlasting destruction if they didn't listen to me? If my religion was the only one that God accepted, why hadn't God made it a more level playing field?
I love that excerpt in part because you actually hit exactly on what my own sort of struggles with Christianity were as a child. Like the idea that, like, wait a minute, there are billions of other people out there, you know? Like, yeah, are they just all going to hell? And someone telling me, yes, they are. It was evangelical church that I was going to at the time. And that was almost a deal breaker for me. There was ultimately, actually, the deal broke when they told me that you could sin as much as you wanted and then have a deathbed conversion and it would still count. And I was like,
that's what I'm going to do.
I was like, well, then why not? Why doesn't everybody do that? That seems like a little too easy out for me.
Yeah.
But speaking of things that we came to believe as children or came to question as children, I would really love it if you could describe the belief system of Jehovah's Witness as time allows, because I think it's a religion that a lot of people have heard of And of course, we've seen a Jehovah's Witness perhaps come to our door or, you know, passing out tracts at the mall. But there are some things that make it particularly, I wouldn't say overall completely unique, but it is more distinct than perhaps people realize.
Yeah, I'm always surprised how little people know about Jehovah's Witnesses, because everyone knows of Jehovah's Witnesses, but just I think the issue is that most people in the Western world kind of just think of them as this background scenery and aren't really interested in engaging with them or finding out what they have to say. And I know this because I used to knock on doors 70 hours a month, and there were very few doors that opened, or if they did open to any kind of, you know, reception at all. It was usually someone saying they weren't interested. But yeah, most people, if you ever just picked up one of their watchtowers from the cart where they're witnessing in the mall or in the subway, you would find kind of like an overview of what they believe. Essentially, almost everything stems back to the belief that they believe the world is ending any day now, that we're living in the last days, and that an Armageddon is about to come, and that Armageddon is God's war to end wickedness. So to the Jehovah's Witnesses, what that means is that everyone on earth who is not a Jehovah's Witness will be destroyed. And that's kind of the impetus for almost, like, for a lot of the religion, for a lot of what their motivations are, because they think that it's their duty to, you know, evangelize and spread this message to save as many people as they can before the end comes. It also sort of is this underpinning that affects the way that a Jehovah's Witness will live their life, because if you think the world is ending tomorrow, what is the point of, you know, going to college? What is the point of getting a career? What is the point of, like, I mean, I didn't even know what a retirement fund was when I was a Jehovah's Witness. Because, like, even our parents' parents, like my mom, when she was early teens, she was told, you'll never graduate high school. Like, the end will come by then for sure. And here now my mom's in her 70s. So when you believe the world is ending that fully and strongly, it really affects your outlook on life. And what it leads to in other aspects are some of the more maybe people have heard of some of these beliefs and just they sound kind of weird. But for example, they don't allow you to take blood transfusions, even if it saves your life. And the reason is they've pulled out, you know, the leaders have pulled out sort of some scriptures that to back that belief up. And really, ultimately, it doesn't matter if you lose your life, because this is not the real life. The real life is after Armageddon, anyone who died faithful will be resurrected back to earth, and basically paradise will be restored. So that kind of leads to that sort of thinking. And then also even there's another aspect of the religion where if anyone dissents or doesn't believe in the religion anymore, or even commits a sin that they're not repentant enough for, they are kicked out of the congregation, shunned. And this is done as a means of trying to essentially, so like tough love, try to get people back in to the organization before it's too late.
You know, I could actually probably spend this whole hour just talking about the theology of Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah. Because I mean, that's just the surface. Yeah.
Because there's so much that's interesting to me. One, I'll add a historical footnote, which is that they're theological descendants of the Millerites, right?
Yeah.
Which was a revival movement. I can't remember the guy's first name. Miller. George Miller, I think.
I think it's William.
William Miller, who's famous in part because there's been studies done about that congregation, because he had a very specific end date, you know, for the world to end, and end date for the end. And it didn't happen, and people redoubled their faith.
Yeah.
And it's become
kind of a really interesting phenomenon. Yeah.
It's a phenomenon that now people like refer to the Millerites in order to describe other kinds of similar events, like the QAnon people, right? When QAnon keeps failing to come true, when the Mueller report turned out to not be arresting a bunch of pedophiles, people will just embrace their belief all the harder. So Jehovah's Witness are the kind of end product of that redoubling of belief from the Millerites.
It is a fascinating phenomenon. And Jehovah's Witnesses is like, even after when they branched off and became their own religion from their original roots, they've picked out dates too along the way. And every time Armageddon didn't come, up to the last time they did this was like 1975, and then it didn't come. But it's remarkable how, something could fail so utterly, but yet you could believe in it even more strongly. Because you have to. You're so invested in it.
And there's another thing that may seem small to people, but I think it'll be significant as a way of marking out just how cut off from the so-called, I guess, not the real world. You guys were the real world. Jehovah's Witnesses, the real world from our false world, is there's no celebration of holidays, right?
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention that, which is a very unusual thing. Yeah, no birthdays, no Christmas, not really any holidays, like even public holidays. And there's always some underlying reason. For example, most of the reasons are because there's pagan roots in Christmas, like the tree is like an old pagan symbol. You know, July 4th, Jehovah's Witnesses are politically neutral, so they are sort of anti-nationalism. There's a lot of different reasons, but essentially what it accomplishes is a sort of separation. Like, it keeps you in a society within a greater society and creates the ability to sort of have this, you know, us versus them dynamic that gives the group structure and form in a way.
Another footnote that I find fascinating is that we do have Jehovah's Witnesses to thank for not having to say the Pledge of Allegiance in school.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a strange, they, and I believe the American Atheists actually were joint plaintiffs in the case, which, if memory serves me correctly, is actually in New Jersey. I don't know why I know these things, but...
An unlikely alliance, those two.
An unlikely alliance, but I mean, it's something, it is, you know, two wrongs can make a right, I guess. I don't know, stop clock, something like that.
Yeah.
Let's move on to China, because one of the most fascinating aspects of a really interesting life that you've led is that you had to go someplace quite repressive to gain your freedom. And you talked about it a little bit when you were talking about when you gave us a description of the book overall. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little more about that, finding freedom, a kind of freedom in that structure.
Yeah, it was very unexpected. When I was what we called a pioneer, is basically a missionary who goes out preaching 70 hours a month, could be anywhere in your home city, another country. Jehovah's Witnesses, for the large part, fund themselves when they do a mission like this. But for me, I had started studying the Bible with Chinese immigrants in my home city of Vancouver, and then slowly became more interested in learning Mandarin. And because, as I mentioned, most people in Canada did not open their doors even, and you're spending 70 hours a month, it can be quite boring. I sort of started to think about going to another country, going to China eventually. But I didn't know how the work was done there, because given the nature of the fact that we were illegal in China, no one was allowed to say if they were there, how we did the work. So it wasn't like I went there looking for freedom. I went there thinking I was, you know, in these last few months before Armageddon, I'm going to convert a bunch of, you know, people that have never had a chance to learn the truth before. When I got there, though, it was very different, because to illustrate, if you're a Jehovah's Witness in anywhere else in the world, you go to 5 meetings a week at the Kingdom Hall. You go to preaching meetups multiple times a week. The spare time you have when you're not working, say, a part-time job to support yourself, which is what most of us did, you would be doing Bible studies, studying the Watchtower publications. And then when you weren't doing that, if you were ever going to do some socializing, it was always done with Jehovah's Witnesses. So your life revolved around the organization. In China, because it was underground when we got there, there was hardly anyone there that was a Jehovah's Witness. And so there just wasn't the same structures. For example, there was only one meeting a week, and it was in a different location, secret location every week. And then for preaching, you were in this city of, I think, 20 million people on your own, because the other Jehovah's Witnesses who were there lived in all different parts of the city. So you were basically told to just start doing your preaching by getting to know random people that you met. And unlike at home, the most I would get to know someone was like go to their door, and if they didn't want to be receptive to my message, I wouldn't become their friend. Even workmates, I would keep at arm's length. But in China, we were told to make friends with people first and get to know them more deeply before we ever brought up the Bible, just to make sure they were safe and that they wouldn't turn us into the government. So what that had, that effect that had on me was that as long as I kept secret what I was doing, I would never hopefully be found out by the government. Like, in that sense, no, I wasn't free. I didn't have religious freedom. But I had a strange religious freedom in the sense that my life was suddenly opened up to new people, to new ways of using my time. Mm-hmm. And that was really strange for a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, you write in the book a fair amount about having to just create these instances of meeting people, which sounds terrifying to me. By the way, like, I can't, I am in awe.
I think it's
one
of
your
cocktail parties now.
Oh, I imagine you are.
I can just go talk to anyone.
It is. I was like, it was like reading like a Stephen King novel for me to like, oh, she's going to have to talk to a stranger.
So
oh, my God. How's she going to do it? But it also put me in mind of something that I think is an interesting through line in the book right up from beginning to the very end, which is the process of evangelism. Like, what is evangelism, right?
Yeah.
Because there's the kind of evangelism that we think of when we think of the Jehovah's Witness, which is the walking up to someone in your garb, your noticeable yeah. garb, like you're yeah. proclaiming who you are right away,
yeah.
having the literature, right? Mm-hmm. And basically asking a yes or no question of the person, right?
Yeah.
Like, do you want to talk further about your soul?
Yeah.
Yes, no, okay, I'm on to the next person. And then there's the kind of evangelism that you were kind of forced into, which is something more like, which I associate with AA, believe it or not. I'm in 12-step program.
This is really good. It's an interesting connection.
Which is, in AA, we talk about having a program of attraction, not promotion. Mm-hmm. Which means you never like tell someone you need to be in AA. Well, never. Sometimes you tell people that because you're human.
Yeah.
But the idea is you do not try to recruit people to AA, you know? Like,
yeah.
Instead, it's a little different, but instead you just try to live a life that seems attractive, you know?
Yeah.
And you just are a person who is sober, and if someone's interested, they can ask you. Mm-hmm. That to me is one pole, maybe. And then you had what happened in China, which is sort of between those two things for
yeah.
you, right? Like, it was a little closer to the, like, attraction, not promotion, but you're also trying to get something done. You had an ulterior motive.
Yeah, it definitely felt more to the ulterior motive side. But it's interesting when you raise it, I was thinking how funny, I had never thought of that in the sense that you have this visceral identity as a Jehovah's Witness in your, you know, the Western world. And you're right, when I was there, that identity was shed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange because then you're interacting with people with an altered state already.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, I think it's probably people are much more inclined to listen to you if you're already a friend than if you're this person coming and shoving something down their throat. So in a way, maybe that was why it was a lot easier to start Bible study there. But also it was easier because, you know, they didn't even know what Jehovah's Witnesses were. So there was like no jokes on late night TV about, like, you know, it was a little bit different. They didn't have any of the backstory.
Right. But I actually think that, yeah, it does not surprise me at all that you would have done better witnessing. So, I mean, however you wanted to define it, like there, you would have had more, quote unquote, yeah. success in a place where what you were trying to do was establish a relationship first. And
definitely.
Then
and then
slip in, trying to slip in the you know, ulterior motive. But
yeah, definitely. It's like the soft sell
yeah.
instead of the hard sell.
But here's something that I was thinking as I read, though. I mean, something that I feel like I've had to learn the hard way, both in terms of like AA and in terms of just my own personal relationships, is that as soon as you want a specific thing from someone, as soon as you want them to believe a specific thing, you've mm-hmm. kind of, it's hard, it becomes harder.
Yeah.
Because that ulterior motive just, it weakens the relationship.
Yeah, I think it's like the weight of expectation is one thing. And it also takes away the ability to authentically connect mm-hmm. with a person.
I think it's interesting to me, there's almost like there was evangelism in reverse happening for you.
Yeah, I think that's true. It was very, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but looking back now, I definitely think that's true.
Because these other people didn't have ulterior motive, right?
No.
They just wanted to be your friend.
Yeah.
And in a way, you learned that. Like, you learned about having a connection with people that wasn't based on religion.
Yes, and completely. And also about, you know, relationships that weren't conditional on belief mm-hmm. or believing the same thing,
mm-hmm.
which was very new to me because in Jehovah's Witnesses, the second you don't believe everything, you're put out, you're shunned,
mm-hmm.
you're considered like dangerous and subversive. So that, you know, every relationship as a Jehovah's Witness, I wouldn't have realized this at the time until I started to doubt things and saw exactly how fragile and conditional those relationships were. And it's a very different kind of basis on which you form the bonds with people in your life.
Yeah, in a way, they were doing the attracting, not promoting, I think, because they were offering you a vision of life in which people did have relationships that were based on just being interested in each other, right? And not sharing the same belief system.
Yeah, I think about that with Jean, the Bible student I mentioned in the reading. She would just share things about her belief system without any desire to convert me to Confucianism. She just thought it was interesting to share. And I know that that was why she studied the Bible with me, because it felt like we were on this equal footing. I mean, we taught each other about the Bible or Confucianism, but we also taught each other about food. Like, she would introduce me to all delicious Chinese foods, and I would introduce her to cappuccinos.
That doesn't seem fair, by the way, I have to say.
Like, yeah, and then, I know, right?
I think you got the good end of the deal there.
Exactly. Although the funny part is that the price was the same. Like, a cappuccino costs the same as, like, a four-course meal. Because, you know, it's an import. But and then also language and culture, you know, we would sort of almost have this exchange where we would teach each other the words that we didn't know and the things that we didn't understand about each other's culture.
Did you know that millennials have three times as much student debt as their parents? That's not right. But you can get your student loans right by refinancing your loans with SoFi. It's a fast and easy process. It's all online and only takes 2 minutes to check your rate. Refinancing your student loans could save you thousands of dollars. SoFi is the leading student loan refinancer in the United States. They've refinanced hundreds of thousands of student loans, and 98% of SoFi members would recommend SoFi to a friend. It's fast, easy, and all online, and you can get your rate again in just 2 minutes. Just lock in that fixed low rate and make one simple monthly payment. It's that easy. And when you refinance your student loans with SoFi, you also get access to SoFi membership, which offers exclusive benefits to help you get ahead in your money, life, and career. Check your rate in 2 minutes on SoFi.com/friends. That's SoFi.com/friends. SoFi Lending Corp, CFL number 6054612. Friends, let's talk about Rothy's. You're a regular listener to the show. You know that they have the seal of approval of activists everywhere, including some very specific activists that are friends of the pod. I love my Rothy's, and I was thinking they're actually kind of the perfect shoe for this time of year, at least in Minnesota, because they are both cool in the sense that they breathe. They're also machine washable, and they also won't like stretch out or be weird in the rain. And we're in this period right now here in Minneapolis where it's both stinking, sticky, hot, and thunderstorms. So it's good to have a comfortable shoe that won't cause blisters, whether it's wet or dry. And they're also like, I mean, this is important. They're very cool looking. I love my red camo ones. They are stylish, sustainable, comfortable, washable, really all you need in a pair of shoes. They're the perfect flats for life on the go. They go with yoga pants. They go with dresses and skirts. They are seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. They're ultra comfortable. And as soon as you slip them on, you will know because there's zero break-in period. It'll blow your mind that they're made of those recycled plastic water bottles. They don't look like it, but you are saving the planet as you walk. Rothy's are manufactured in zero-waste factories, and they ship directly in the shoebox, no unnecessary packaging. These are the feel-good flats you'll want in more ways than one. Plus, Rothy's also come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. There's no risk, no worries, no reason not to try them. Check out all the amazing styles available right now at rothys.com/WFLT. Go to rothys.com, rothys.com/WFLT to get your new favorite flats. Comfort, style, and sustainability, these are the shoes that you have been waiting for. Head to rothys.com/WFLT today.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Let's move to a much more literal version of attraction, not promotion, and your departure from the faith. which is your relationship with Jonathan. Tell us a little bit about that, because it's a significant turning point in the book and your life, for that matter.
Yes.
So who was Jonathan?
So Jonathan, I ended up getting part-time work in Shanghai as a podcaster, which was like the first wave of podcasting back in 2006, 2007. And he was a customer. He listened to the shows. And in that era, there was not any social media yet, but we did have online forums. And my job was to be the online community sort of manager. And I would interact with all of the customers and listeners to the podcast. And sometimes they would write me emails. And it was my job to be friendly and answer their questions. And Jonathan started writing me like any other person did for the job. But for some reason, we just kept talking like more over email. And it was always topics to do with China or learning Chinese. But then, you know, one day he started G-chatting me. And then I started coming to work and I would find myself G-chatting with him almost every day. And it was just sort of an innocuous friendship almost. I didn't even know what he looked like. He lived in Los Angeles. But over time, our friendship, as I feel like online friendships can easily do, it became deeper and more personal more quickly than maybe it would have in person, because there was no person in front of you. You could maybe reveal more or something. And keep in mind, at this time, I was married, and I had been a Jehovah's Witness my entire life, and I had kept worldly people at bay my entire life. But I was, I think because there was no body, there was no person, it didn't seem wrong. Like, I just felt like it was, I was part of my job.
Well, I want to interject a couple of things here. One, I think it's important kind of to understand the context that you probably didn't even know what an emotional affair was, right?
No.
Like that idea that this would be anything forbidden. I mean, I'm sure it started to come up as it started to get more forbidden.
Yeah.
but I it seems to me like you were earnestly somewhat innocent in pursuing this relationship.
Yeah, like it just sort of evolved.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I mean, I think I was quite naive just because of the nature of how I had grown up.
Right.
And it also wasn't like he had some drive either. Like, he knew I was married. He was not trying to bring this to the next level. It's just as these things happen, they sort of, all of a sudden, when you wake up and you're like, I think I have feelings for this person.
And he was, and as he got to know you and discovered you were a Jehovah's Witness, he began actually, this is an interesting case study for the, if it matters if you have an ulterior motive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he definitely had something of ulterior motive. I wonder if it's worth distinguishing the fact that he definitely wanted to leave the witnesses, right? Like, was that, well, actually tell me, does that how you thought of it? Or did you think of it as a debate? Maybe that matters to how you how it wound up going.
Well, the second Jonathan found out that I was a Jehovah's Witness, which I told him in code, because we can't say these things online in China because people are spying. He had a very strong reaction. And he lives in Los Angeles. And I think because he's like worked a lot with Scientologists, he's sort of been a person who's interested in cults. And he knew a little bit about Jehovah's Witnesses, but not a lot. But based on things that I had said, you know, in the course of our conversations, he basically came out and said, "Ah, I knew it when I told him." He's like, "I knew that you were under the control of something." And that really made me mad, because I'm a pretty strong personality. If you told me that someone was controlling me, I would be really beg to differ with you. And I did. anyways, but it wasn't like, I mean, I don't think he ever set off thinking he's going to deprogram me from a cult. But I think that he just didn't want to see someone that he knew not seeing who they were. I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think he was probably attracted to me and on some level wanted me out because Jehovah's Witness, whatever. You know, we were like very morally pure. But I don't really think that was his initial motive. I think he's just a really helpful person. He's actually a very kind person and he cares about people. And I don't think everyone would have bothered taking the time to try and show somebody, you know, the fact that they were under suffering from indoctrination. But he did. It was just something about him that he felt motivated to do it.
I am really interested in how this does and doesn't fit into the attraction, not promotion, ulterior motive paradigm. Because it does seem to me that there's one level in which like he definitely would have preferred you not be a Jehovah's Witness, right? That's an ulterior motive. But at the same time, there was a couple other messages happening. You know, one, he was attracted to you, right? Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a fuzzy, warm, fuzzy feeling, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Overall. And that also conveys a sense of acceptance, right? Even if you hadn't, even if you stayed a Jehovah's Witness, he was still attracted to you. So there's this sort of like warm feeling of like, oh, we have this thing that's separate of whether or not I stay a Jehovah's Witness, which is this attraction.
That's true, because as a Jehovah's Witness, say if there was ever, and I wasn't thinking this way at the time, but I can say this now looking back, is that if there was ever a Jehovah's Witness man who was attracted to me and then I was like, oh, I don't believe in it anymore, he would stop.
Right.
So you're right. Maybe it was the first time that someone sort of showed this kind of deep interest in me. And I, you know, we had this very ongoing, interesting conversation and we laughed a lot. But also it wasn't dependent on whether I believed or I didn't believe.
Yeah. Because I think that's sort of a very interesting variation on this paradigm, right? Is that mm-hmm. you're still conveying like, I am a safe space for you. Well, maybe we shouldn't use that exact wording, but the attraction, the acceptance. You know, no matter what you believe, I have this relationship with you, this warm relationship with you. And you don't have to change your mind for you to enjoy this warm relationship.
Yeah, because we would argue and I would tell him why he was wrong and he would tell me why I was wrong. And then we would just go back to talking. Like it wasn't like it was a deal breaker. There were a lot of other things to talk about, too.
So spoiler alert for people who are going to read the book. Maybe it will tell them, stop listening. I'll let you know, we'll figure out a code to have you come back in. But so spoiler alert, you do consummate this relationship with Jonathan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll let you talk a little bit about that. I have questions.
Oh, I'm an open book.
Well, I can try to sum it up. So you have these really strong doubts, right? But by the time you flew out and you somewhat concocted an excuse to see him, right? Like you were going to go visit friends in Mexico, but you
totally.
Had to stop in Los Angeles. Oh, what a lucky coincidence, you know?
Yeah. So the background to that is that I had started to, like, as this was like ongoing over a year, so it wasn't something that happened overnight, but my marriage was like, we got married very young, and it probably should have been like a year-long college romance. That's what it would have been for anyone else. But because you're a Jehovah's Witness, you can't have sex unless you get married, and then you get married for the wrong reasons, and then you realize, like, oh, you're 5 years later, you're a completely different person. But you're not allowed to split up unless someone commits adultery. Mm. So by the time I had been married now, by the time I met with, you know, engaging in this conversation with Jonathan, I had been married for probably like 8 or 9 years. And it had been a very dead relationship for a long time. So as these things like do, it was coming to some sort of climax in the sense that in more ways than one, I was starting to have doubts about my religion.
Good choice of words. I don't know. I mean, you don't get into that much detail in the
book.
Many
more ways than one. Exactly. But I think that their religious side was starting to, like, these things, they can't go on forever. Right. They're going to come to some kind of conclusion, or if you're in a religion like mine, some kind of apocalypse.
Right.
Because that's how you know how to change your life, I guess. So there was a religious side, but there was also the relationship side, in that the more this relationship with Jonathan deepened, you know, I still had never met him or like sort of admitted to ourselves that we were even having an emotional affair. It became more and more obvious to me how wrong my relationship felt, my marriage. So I had started to have these conversations with my husband, asking him, you know, do you love me? Like, why is our relationship like this? And in every discussion, he would basically admit that he didn't love me, but that it was the right thing to do, to stay together because we were Jehovah's Witnesses, and that if we waited till paradise, everything would be okay. Well, the problem for me was that I used to think that was the case, and that's why I could stay in this sort of intolerable situation. But then when I start to believe there's maybe this paradise isn't actually coming, well, then I kind of was like, well, how do we stop? How do I get out of this? I don't believe that anymore. So, yes, I don't think I was like intentionally planning to go there and consummate my this relationship with Jonathan, but subconsciously I was looking for some way to blow it up because I needed to make a change. I couldn't keep doing what I was doing.
And that's really, as someone who has had occasions in her life to do big dramatic things because of a dude.
Yeah.
I found this part especially interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does seem like you, as you said it, I'll just draw it out a little bit more, which is that you had this incredibly deep conditioning, deep relationship with being a Jehovah's Witness almost your entire life. It's what you knew, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, an extreme belief needs an extreme apostasy, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you weren't going to get out of that by just sinning a little, you know?
No, because the thing is like, even when you start to sort of drop away, you can't just, like, fade away. For example, I have these friends who don't believe in it anymore, and they've been still going to the meetings, and the way that they're going to get out is by moving to another country.
I mean, that's, I'm not extreme joking. In its own way, people do. I guess, you know?
Yeah, it's like, I call it the witness protection program, in the sense just that the elders will start hounding you because, you know, they really genuinely think you're going to lose your life, that Armageddon's coming tomorrow. It's not like they're evil. They're mm-hmm. just like victims of victims. Like, we've been all taught this when we were kids. But the problem is, if you want to keep your family and not get shunned, you have to sort of like just disappear, because the second they find out you don't believe, you're going to get disfellowshipped and the whole thing's going to blow up. So for me, in my situation, I, like, there was no way to just, like, sort of slip out of there or slink out of the religion. I was in a pretty prominent position as a sort of missionary in China, and my husband was an elder. And I also think there was a fear in myself, in a way, that it's easy to get pulled back into it. Like, I knew some things were wrong by the time I got to this point, but I still had a lot of fear. I still kind of believed that it was mostly true, but then I was just unable to keep doing it because it didn't feel true enough anymore. But it's like there's this sort of pull. It's like this gravitational pull. It's the only world you know mm-hmm. from basically from childhood. So how do you make a break from it? It's not easy.
So you had to pin the scarlet letter on your own chest, kind of. Like, yeah. You're right.
Totally.
I did that.
And I kind of owned it. Like, I didn't, it was weird. It was, although it sort of seemed not my image of who I thought I was, I remember after it happened, I was really horrified that I would have ever, you know, cheated on someone. But all the same, I was like, I just felt, yeah, I did it. And also, you're in the framework of a society where that's the only way to get out is to do it with somebody. You can't end the marriage because of irreconcilable differences. You have to have sex with someone else in order to get divorced. So when that's the framework you're operating with, that's sort of the only way you see out.
And people may have picked up from the way that we're talking about this, the other twist in this story, which is that it turns out that was not a relationship that lasted. In fact, extremely not lasted. From the way you tell it in the book, it was he ghosted you, as the kids say, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was more, but, like, you know, sorry, just as an aside, the book could have gone on with 500 more G-chats, but at the end of the day, that was essentially what, yes, happened.
he was done, and that's, whatever, I don't want to get in the psychology of that, because it seems like you still have a fairly generous attitude towards him.
Yeah.
But, again, so as a woman who's had some parallel things happen in my own life, mm-hmm. where I've done something because of a relationship, and then the relationship turns out not to be the thing.
Yeah.
Talk about what that shift was like. It must have been some ways, I mean, it was both dark but empowering, perhaps.
Well, there's two ways to think about it. I can talk about it from the state of mind I was in then versus now.
Right,
so you
right.
see a lot more with time. At the time, I was devastated. I didn't have anyone else. Everyone had already shunned me. And then this Jonathan was kind of like this lifeline. And he is a very supportive person by nature. Mm-hmm. However, you know, how that support can look when you're on the other side of the world versus whether you're living in a same house together. Like, how much could you be that supportive of someone if they were in your space every day?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's sort of like on call at night, 1 hour, it's maybe a lot easier than something that is more holistic. Also, like, looking back to speak to how I think of it now, is the sense, like, who would do that? Like, it's not normal for somebody to just start deprogramming someone and spending, like, hours and hours talking to them online, trying to help. You know, there was a certain dynamic going on there where I think Jonathan felt like he was kind of saving me. And he started to seem to me kind of, I didn't think of this at the time, but a little bit like my savior.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that is not a basis to start off a healthy relationship,
yeah.
you know. especially to someone who's like in a religion that's used to having like a Jesus figure, you know?
Yeah. In my case, my parallel happening, I wound up being incredibly grateful for the space that gave me.
Yeah.
Right. Because I know if that relationship had been successful, just to speak in the 12-step program sort of terms, I probably would be dead by now. Like,
yeah.
Just because I don't think I could have stayed sober because I wasn't doing it for myself.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a lot of parallels, yeah.
Yeah, I had to have my heart broken so that I could be the one to fix it.
Yeah.
Instead of having some dude, which is my story of my life, prior to that, was having someone fix me, you know? I was in a place where only I could fix me. I never would have gotten there on my own. I never would have chosen to fix myself.
No, it's too hard.
Oh, God. You know, yeah.
You don't choose it. It chooses you.
But
or you subconsciously choose it, I think, maybe.
Yeah, that's sort of where I've kind of landed. And I definitely, in reading your story, I see that for sure.
Yeah.
You know, like you had to do what you had to do to get out of there.
And also, if I had, let's say I had embarked on a relationship with Jonathan at that moment and gotten married, I would have been doing the exact same thing I had done at, you know, age of 22 and when I married my husband, is that I didn't know myself. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And here I am, like, attaching myself to a man without even really fully knowing what I need. And ultimately, like you say, looking back, you know, 10 years go by, and I'm like, oh, no, it was not what I needed. It's not what I wanted, even. But at the time, I thought I did. So, yeah, you're right. I think it's the same thing that you went through.
Would you buy a T-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? Of course you wouldn't. And that is why you and I love Everlane. You will never overpay for your clothes. They only make the premium essentials using the finest materials without traditional markups. They want you to know what you're paying for and why. So they tell you their real costs, and they are radically transparent about every step in the process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. No matter your style or preference, Everlane's clothes look better, cost less, and last longer. And because Everlane sells directly to you, their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. I happen to love their summer weight jeans that they came out with this year. That sounds weird. I'd never actually conceived of an idea of summer weight jeans, but they're basically like the thinnest, lightest denim you can make. Again, in these sticky summer days, that's a very good thing to have. And they fit incredible. I don't know if it's the trend or it's my age, but I like a good mid-rise jeans these days, and these are the perfect mid-rise jeans. Right now, you can check out my personalized collection at everlane.com/friends, and you will get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/friends, everlane.com/friends. Cats are natural-born predators, and there is nothing they like better than the thrill of a good chase. And that is why the folks at Petronix invented Mouser, a fully autonomous robotic mouse that sounds actually kind of scary, that can actually sense and react to how your cat is playing. Mouser even has an all-day play mode, so you can turn it on when you leave the house, and Mouser will wake up whenever your cat wants to play. It has fully customizable auto-play modes, a smartphone remote control interface, and interchangeable tail attachments, which are like these fuzzy little things, like feathery things like cats like to play with. Mouser is the last toy your cat will ever need. And here I will let you in a little behind-the-scenes negotiation that happened about this sponsor, which is that we are fighting over who gets to use the sample that they sent. Brock, my producer, and I both have multiple cats. We are cat people. And you know, like, I need to see how it works, but also he needs to see how it works. And instead of actually seeing, we're still arguing, I think we're probably just going to take turns. That would be the wise thing to do. But you can look on YouTube for how cats interacted with it. And while I do find the prospect of an AI mouse in my house a little creepy, I already know that the cats are really going to love this. The real problem is going to be if the dog loves it, too. Now, if you want to investigate Petronix, you can right now get 20% off by visiting petronix.io/friends. Using the code friends at checkout, that's P-E-T-R-O-N-I-C-S.io /friends with checkout code FRIENDS to save 20%, because your cat is worth it. Here we can move on to, let's update everybody to today, in a way,
yeah.
Because that experience that I had, I sometimes look at as, I'm not going to use the word proof, but I'm going to use it as, I'm going to say that experience to me suggests the existence of my higher power,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, I realize, like, I'm the one seeing the patterns. You know, I'm the one who looks back and imposes, like, yep, that's the way it had to happen.
Yeah.
Right? But also, there's a part of me that's like, you know, that worked out in a way that it needed to work out. Perhaps there mm-hmm. is something somewhere that has a part in that. Where are you these days?
It's hard for me to think in those terms because it's not that I actually do believe in some higher force, power. I feel like our language doesn't have the right word to describe it, because every word that I use, if I say a god or create, like being, all of these things have been co-opted by religion.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely don't think of spirituality or like God in those terms of religious terms. I think I'm a little more of the camp where I think things happen because of sometimes just the right combination of circumstances, and also because of what you attract at that time or what you're attracted to. And I've done a lot of reading and come to the conclusion that I think sometimes you're attracted to someone because you need to learn that thing. Like, it's not resolved in you, and that you invite that person into your life because they're going to actually kind of teach you something that maybe you need to know. So I think that's kind of where I land at this point, rather than thinking there's any kind of higher direction. Because I think for me, what's happened, not for more spoilers, but like...
No, we should. I was going to say, this is an important, there's actually an important sort of shaping fact here.
Yeah, because after I left the religion many years later, I suffered terrible tragedy, my son dying on his first day in daycare. And to me, if there were any kind of higher power directing something, I don't think that anything would direct something like that to happen. Or if they did, maybe it would happen to someone like, it was really evil. I don't know. Like, it just doesn't seem like, it doesn't,
right.
I'd have to reconcile all those things. I'm sorry to even laugh, but it is classic.
This is almost, I mean, there have literally been books written from the premise of a child's death being the thing that makes, if that is the loudest renunciation or the most vivid case against a higher power, is the death of an innocent.
Yeah. So basically, I think I was already at a point where it's hard for me to not think that kind of is such a huge event and tragedy that happened in my life, it's hard for it not to override any other experience of God or whatever you want to use, whatever word you want to use. I guess that's sort of what the mechanism at play for me is.
Yeah. I feel almost bad even like having dragged you into this discussion without putting that in the foreground, because it is...
It's okay, actually. I like it because for me, a lot of times I think people, they ignore the topic and they can't... I think about it all the time, of course. My son's always on my mind. So it's actually kind of a relief when someone's willing to talk about it, to be honest. A lot of people don't want to talk about it.
I found that section of the book incredibly compelling. I mean, it's very honest. And you don't end, it's beautifully written, but you don't end in a neat place, right? Philosophically, because that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is a messy world. It's a messy existence. But you do kind of leave open, when I was reading it, I did still want to ask you about where you are with your spiritual, you're right, the language is not, all the language has been co-opted.
I know what you mean, though.
You know, because I call myself a Christian, but I don't even like that term, you know. I actually would prefer follower of Christ. He was a cool dude. I try to be Christ-like. I try to follow the example of Christ in my life. But you do leave open, because I think you have to, some breathing space for a power, a source, a entity. That demon sounds wrong. But I was wondering when I got to the end of the book, like, where is she now? What makes sense to her now?
Well, here's the thing is that, for example, even just a loss, like the loss of my son, is a loss so utterly devastating. And, you know, he's gone. Mm-hmm. Like, he is literally gone. Some people see their child, like, in the wind or, like, a goat. Like, I don't see that. He's gone. He doesn't exist on this world anymore. But, you know, there's certain things you can't reconcile. So some people might think that by me saying that, I'm like, oh, well, I don't believe in anything of the spiritual realm. But there's a lot of things you can't reconcile with the idea that there's nothing. Like, there's absolutely nothing. Because, for example, he's gone, but, you know, like, I can conjure up memories of him. I have something of him. Like, what is that? Is that spiritual realm? I don't know. I also think about how he used to look at me with this look that was transcendent. It was nothing I've ever experienced before, this sort of look of love and adoration, just like connection that I had with him. And although he's gone, it doesn't feel like that's gone, because that's just something that stays with you. It's so numinous, or I don't know, as again, there's no words. It's so beautiful. And then there's like other things, like from being a very small child, I think I sort of transferred these feelings onto religion, but I've always been a person with kind of a spiritual nature. And I would sometimes even like get sort of transcendent experiences in nature or in reading literature, this type of thing. So I just feel that there's like all these dimensions beyond that physical dimension, that there's no way I can say that this is it. Because even in our own minds, there's like a multitude of things. I mean, so ultimately, where I'm at now is that I just think that there's a ton of things that are just a mystery and that maybe one day we'll understand. But right now, like, as human beings, we're pretty small. Our lives are very short. And this is what we've got. And we've actually got quite a lot right in front of us. So I've tried to sort of trade in this idea of needing to know everything. Because one thing about a religion like the Jehovah's Witnesses is that they have the answers to all of this stuff. It was great. It was so relaxing. I knew everything. I knew why people died. I knew what was going to happen after we died. But when you realize it's not actually true, it's just something that we want to believe is true. You're trading it in and you're in the here and now, and you're almost like appreciating everything that you actually do have. And that to me feels like a form of spirituality. And I think it's hard for us to come around to these ways of thinking because we're so used to religion having this monopoly on spiritual experiences. So we just sort of think of it as something religious, but I don't think it has anything to do with religion, actually. I think it has to do with being a human being.
I think that's a great place for us to end our conversation. I have so many more questions, but I assume you're going to write another book or we'll have another occasion to talk to each other.
I hope so.
Because this has been delightful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.
And that is it for today's show, which, to give you yet another peek behind the curtain, got scrambled a little bit because we had some guest mix-ups and cancellations. And that actually gave me the occasion to consider telling you all, you know, if you have to cancel something because of a personal emergency, you should do that. And you shouldn't feel bad about it. If you have a thing you need to address, that thing is more important than anything else. And if the people you're canceling on give you shit about it, that's their problem and not yours. Because it is very, very important. And I must remind you to please take care of yourselves.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too.
Aw.
I mean, just look at the little guy. water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.